All rise. The Supreme Court for the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Pickering presiding.
Please be seated, everyone. First of all, I want to welcome all of you. We're so glad to have you here and to have you participating in the Justice Michael Douglas program. He's a former colleague of Ron's and mine and was a fabulous appellate court judge. I think he's somewhere in the courtroom. There he is.
There he is.
Okay. Back row, far corner, that would be Justice Douglas. Okay, this is the time and place set for oral argument in Brooks versus State. The case number is 88895, and we're going to follow a slightly different procedure than we normally do with oral arguments today, in that at the beginning, I'm going to ask the lawyers to stand up and turn their backs to the bench, which you would never do as a normal lawyer, and introduce themselves to the audience and tell all of you a little bit about them, their professional background, and just a quick overview of what the case is. I know that we send along the materials that are available online, and we're very proud of our docket, our website that allows people, you can look up the briefs, you can look up the appendices in a case, you can find out what's going on in the case as much or as little as you want to know. And I know that Julie Ollum, our court clerk here, had sent that information along. But law is a little bit spoken in a different language, and so it may not be as easy to comprehend on a quick read what the legal issues are. So the lawyers are going to set the coordinates for that for you guys before we get underway today. But you wouldn't ordinarily see that. I would ordinarily just call the case, and the lawyers would stand up, and they'd be ready to go. One more thing, and this is something you may not know about appellate procedure, but the case goes through the trial court, and all the witnesses are heard, and there's a jury, and the jury makes a decision, and so that could take weeks. But by the time it gets to us, we're only looking at errors, and the errors that are argued are ones that are distilled through that process. And so we've further limited the time spent. So the lawyers operate on a clock, and you'll see a clock up there that says 17 minutes, and that will run down during the course of the time the lawyers are speaking. So they only have 17 minutes, and that's the distillation of all of the prior proceedings in the case. So they've really winnowed through what are the issues and what they want to talk about and figured out what are the fine points. And the appellant wants to have the case reversed, and the respondent usually wants to have it affirmed, although that's not invariable. But they pick up, they choose their sides, and then they pick the issues. The appellant gets to set the issues that he or she wants to discuss. The respondent answers them, and then we make a ruling. At the conclusion of the arguments today, we're going to let the lawyers answer questions that you all may have about the case. And we've forewarned the lawyers that that's coming. Again, that's kind of unusual in the proceeding because usually when they've spent their 17 minutes, they're done. So they get to talk to you a little bit about the end of the case. One of the things that's unusual about an appellate proceeding is we don't announce our decision at the end of today, so you won't know how we rule. We'll give you a written ruling later after we meet among the three of us and what we call deliberate, and then there'll be either an opinion or an order that's entered. That comes with a little bit of a limit, which is we can't answer questions from you all about how we're going to rule until we decide the case and the three of us discuss it among ourselves and reach a decision. We can't tell you, well, we think, you know, one side or the other is going to rule, or we reject one argument and accept another. So we're going to have to be a little bit, you know, hold you at arm's length on the questions you may have of us. Finally, I want to introduce my colleagues to you, and I should have done that at the outset. To my left is Ron Perigary, and he's the longest serving member currently on the court. By a couple years more than me. And to my right is Justice Linda Bell. She was on the 8th Judicial District Court as a trial court judge and then recently joined the court. And she was the chief judge in charge of the whole 8th Judicial District Court. And it's really my privilege to serve with both of them. So with that, I'd like to ask counsel for the appellant to address the students and then have you address the students, and then we'll formally call the case and get argument underway.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, everyone. My name is Catherine Curry-Diamond, and I am a chief deputy public defender with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I've been practicing law for about 12 years. I know I look like I could go to school with you, but I have been practicing law for about 12 years. I've been on the appellate team for the last 3 years. Before that, I was a trial attorney. Before that, I worked with Brian Scott at the city attorney's office as a prosecutor for a little while. And when I was there, I did over 75 bench trials, and then I went to the public defender's office and I did a number of jury trials, and now I do this. I represent Mr. Brooks, who was the defendant at the lower level, and we came in second, so we're here. The case today before you has, I think, quite some interesting legal issues and not as many factual issues, but I think the legal issues and how the law operates is kind of really what this case is about. But the basic facts are he was subject to a family court proceeding. He was doing a supervised visit with his infant daughter via FaceTime. So he was on FaceTime and participating in this supervised visit. And then he denies, but what the jury found was that he made a threat that there will be a mass shooting at the next court hearing or the next court proceeding. So that's what the jury found him guilty of, is making a terroristic threat. So I'm here today to argue that either there was some legal issue that means he shouldn't be convicted and his case should go away and be dismissed, or that there was some evidentiary error and he's entitled to a new trial because his first trial was fundamentally unfair. So that's kind of what my position is today. So, that's it. This is William Waters. He's the team chief of the appellate team at the Clark County Public Defender's Office and is my supervisor and mentor. And he's here for moral support.
And by the way, I clerked for Justice Douglas 20 years ago. I was a law clerk for Justice Douglas before I went to the public defender's office. And then in district court, I appeared in front of Judge Bell for a couple of years, weekly, every day, a week, every couple of years. But I want to say, Justice Douglas, I haven't seen you in a long time. It's nice to see you again. Great boss. Set me on the course for appellate work, which I am forever appreciative of.
And being an appellate attorney is the best job in the business. And that's all I have to say.
Mr. Waters, that's the least I've ever heard you say.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Elise Conlin. I'm a chief deputy district attorney at the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I've been at the office for almost 8 years. My first year was as a law clerk in the appellate unit. And ever since then, I have been a trial attorney. This case was one of the trials that I did. I have been on several different teams throughout my time in the office. At the beginning, I handled what we call TRAC, which is general litigation crimes. I've gone to the domestic violence team, and I am now currently assigned to the special victims unit. In this case, as my colleague stated, this was occurred during a visitation with Mr. Brooks' daughter. There were some other individuals in the room, including a supervision monitor as part of the court order that it be a supervised visit. And during that, Mr. Brooks was speaking passionately and stating that there would be a mass shooting at the next court hearing. And ultimately, the jury found him guilty of
making a threat or conveying false information regarding an act of terrorism. And so, as my colleague stated, there are various issues that were raised in this case as far as in the appeal that involved jurisdiction, whether certain types of evidence should have come in. And so that's what we're here to talk about tonight. So thank you all. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And I assume you both are familiar with the rule we've instituted, which is the first 2 minutes are yours to speak uninterrupted by any of the three of us. And then after that, it's fair game for us to ask you questions. So with that, I'd like to call the appellant. And please tell the clerk how much time you'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Curry Diamond, and I represent Mr. Brooks in the matter before this court. At the heart of this case are two foundational constitutional principles: the right to be tried in the state where the crime was committed, and the First Amendment freedom of speech and association. First, this court must consider where the conduct constituting the offense occurred. Here, the essential conduct elements were not consummated within the Nevada boundaries as required by NRS 171015, and no act was done within the state as required by NRS 171020. The constitutional guarantee to stand trial where the crime was committed is a cornerstone of American justice. This case also considers the right of a free society to associate, to advocate, to air grievances, to hold beliefs that are unpopular or unique without fear of prosecution. The First Amendment of our state, the First Amendment of the federal constitution and our state constitution both guarantee the absolute freedom of individual belief to be free from weaponization of their belief system as evidence of criminality without a nexus to the crime. These are not procedural technicalities. They are structural guarantees that were denied to Brooks. This case reminds us of the very principles that we protect as practitioners of the law. Your Honors, first to jurisdiction. NRS 171015 requires that a crime be consummated within Nevada's boundaries. NRS 171020 requires that a person do any act within the state. Neither of these jurisdictional requirements were met here. The question that the court must answer is, what are the things the defendant needs to do to violate the statute, and where did those criminal acts occur? NRS 202.448 requires the making of or conveying false information concerning a threat or act of terrorism with the intent to alarm, cause panic, or interrupt government operations. In order to be convicted under the statute, Brooks must communicate that threat through either written, oral, or electronic means. The actus reus of this statute is the making of the threat. That is the criminal conduct. The mens rea is the intent to cause the alarm. Once these two items have come together simultaneously, Brooks has committed the offense. A similar question was addressed by the United States Supreme Court just recently on June 11th in Abu Amo. That court considered whether creating a false document with the intent to obstruct an investigation, whether a jurisdiction lied within the place where the false document was created, or whether it lied where the obstruction took place. The court held that the criminal act was creating the false document with the intent to obstruct, even though no obstruction needed to happen. The same is true here. Brooks just needs to have made the threat with the intent.
Let me ask you this. If he made the threat and no one heard it, is there a crime?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a crime. Now, because Brooks doesn't need to do any other criminal act in order to, or any other act in order to violate the statute, the crime is complete upon making the threat with the requisite intent. Abu Amo also addressed a similar question. In that case, the Supreme Court gave the example that the false document was written and put away in a drawer, but he had the intent at the time the false document was created. The crime has still occurred regardless of whether anyone had seen the false document and reacted to it. The same is true here. If Brooks had written down the threat on a piece of paper and put it away in a drawer, both of the essential elements of the crime are complete. He has the intent to cause alarm, and he's created the threat, regardless of whether anyone sees it. Obviously, practically speaking, that creates an issue for being able to prosecute the case, but that's a different question as to whether or not a criminal act has occurred.
But to push back a little bit on that, does the verb make a threat connote some act, some conveyance of that information into this jurisdiction to the hearer? Like, when you read the statute, would a normal person read that to say, I write down in a note or I'm in the woods and I say, I make a threat with nobody within earshot? Is that truly similar to the statute that's at issue in Abu Amma?
I do believe it is similar in that the Supreme Court in that case said that once he had committed the prohibited act with the requisite intent, he needs to do nothing more to violate the law. The same is true here under these circumstances and under the statute. It's just the making of the threat or the conveying, which means expression of a threat with the intent to alarm, even though there isn't a listener. And we know that the legislature has not legislated a listener in here, because when we look at stalking and harassment, similar crimes, the specific statutory language provides for a receiver of that threat, provides for a listener of the harassment and the threatening language in there.
But how, what is, again, looking at the statute, why do you need an intent to injure, intimidate, or alarm if there wasn't a listener? I mean, it seems like that's surpluses. You've got to have an intent for somebody to be alarmed or intimidated or injured.
Yes, Your Honor, but whether or not someone, but because the court, because the statute doesn't require any kind of effects that someone actually hear the crime, that's actually legislated out of the statute, that's not necessary for the crime to be complete. If Mr. Brooks was in a crowded room and yelling a threat in French with the intent to alarm, and no one in the room speaks French, he has still committed a crime.
If nobody's in the room, how could you have an intent to injure, alarm, or intimidate anybody?
Well, he could still have an intent to alarm or intimidate people by yelling, just because. Yes, I mean, that would be a factual impossibility, but whether or not he's completed the crime in the criminal act, This statute was enacted in 2000. The way that we see it today was enacted largely in 2003, which was the first legislative session right after the 9/11 attacks. The intent behind the statute was to create broad sweeping language in order to criminalize behavior conduct that would be the making of the threat with the requisite intent without any necessary effect, which is no different than if he had sent an email that went to a spam folder. If there's no, even though there is no listener, his crime has still been completed because he still has the intent to do.
And in that regard, this statute is quite similar to the statute in Abu Amma, because there was the intent to obstruct, et cetera, is a requirement of intent at the time he did the act. I mean, I can see the analogy, and I'm glad you raised it in your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Additionally, Your Honor, I think maybe there's an issue with the contemplated effects, whether or not someone actually hears that. This is the same, because it's not legislated into the statute, this is the same argument that United States Supreme Court rejected in Abu Amma. So the Ninth Circuit initially had upheld the conviction on this contemplated effects, that, again, how could you intend to obstruct if no obstruction actually occurs? How could you intend to obstruct if no one actually sees the document that you're creating with the intent? This is the contemplated effects doctrine, and the Supreme Court has said that that is within the legislative ability. If the legislature or if Congress wished for the effects to be an essential element, then that would be written into the statute. Otherwise, we have just contemplated effects that's not required by statute, and that's the rejection of that argument, that contemplated effects is not enough to confer jurisdiction.
But AGWAMA would be persuasive precedent, not mandatory, right?
Well, in the regard that it is referring to the Sixth Amendment, yeah. Your Honor? Well, so yes, the Sixth Amendment hasn't been specifically applied by the United States Supreme Court to apply to, that haven't made a specific finding. However, this court in State versus Stewart in 1958 discussed our state constitutional right to a jury trial. And what they said was the state constitutional right by jury guarantees the vicinage clause of the Sixth Amendment, which was at issue in AGWAMA, although not expressly stated by the state constitution. So although the United States Supreme Court hasn't made a specific ruling that the Sixth Amendment applies to states under the 14th Amendment, our state Supreme Court has found that the vicinage clause does apply to us.
And what's the case you just referred to? I'm sorry.
That would be State versus Stewart, Your Honor. That would be, 74 Nevada 65, and that was 1958, and that was discussing the specific state constitutional right to a jury trial. The state also brings up, and I think Your Honor was implying this about the virtual presence, whether or not he is in both Nevada and Arizona at the same time because he's teleconferencing during this visit. However, NRS 171015, NRS 171020, the general jurisdictional statutes don't provide for general presence, and NRS 202.448 also doesn't provide for general presence or virtual presence.
All of those statutes that were written before, that was really a possibility, right? I mean, how do we navigate our brave new world of people being everywhere at the same time?
So that's obviously, my opinion is that it's part of the legislative authority to do that, right? And 202.448 came about in 1999. It was amended in 2003, and it was amended again in 2007. So obviously, you know, the internet and Facebook and all of those things did exist at the last time that this statute was amended. But if we look back to the harassment statute, that statute came into play in 1989. And in 1989, there was specific long-arm jurisdictional language that was included in the harassment statute. So 10 years prior to the terrorism statute, the harassment statute included long-arm jurisdiction, which says jurisdiction is conferred either where the harassment takes place or where the harassment is received if that person is receiving it within Nevada. So this is, you know, something that the legislature can do. They updated these statutes as recently as 2019 with further long-arm jurisdictional statutory language. And this is something that the United States Supreme Court has also recognized. When they were speaking about AGWAMA, they referenced a case in 1944 in Johnson, and they specifically said that if the Congress wished for jurisdiction to attach where that piece of mail, wherever that piece of mail traveled, they have the legislative ability to do so. And we can't read that into the statute if it's not there. If there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for a rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Elise Conlin, and I represent the state of Nevada, the respondent in this matter. The state requests that this court affirm Solomon Brooks' conviction for making a threat or conveying false information concerning an act of terrorism. The district court had jurisdiction to hear this case. Solomon Brooks was voluntarily present via video phone call during a supervised visit with his daughter. There were other individuals in the room as well, to include his mother, Miss Walker, and a supervision monitor. The that visit was happening in Clark County, Nevada. And during that video call, Mr. Brooks became passionate and started saying, "We are going to raise hell. There will be a mass shooting at the next court hearing." And that was received here in Clark County, Nevada. And NRS 202.448 is complete when someone receives the threat or the false information. When looking at the statutory language of NRS 202.448 and the corresponding statutes that give definition, we see that it does require a receiver. Under the statute that defines oral communication, oral written electronic communication, which was given as instruction 15 in this case, it anticipates a speaker and recipient. The examples given are a package delivered, communication through a cellular telephone, a broadcast, a transmission, all examples that anticipate that there is both a speaker and a recipient. In addition, the language of a threat, and again, the instruction that was given at this trial, includes an expression of a person's purpose or intention toward injury to the person, property, or rights of another. It also includes any kind of expression of intent by one person to do an act against the person at whom the declaration was intended. Again, looking at that language is anticipating that if there is a speaker recipient, both are included in this statute. And
so, Ms. Conlon, if Mr. Brooks had sent an email, but the email wasn't read by the intended recipient, would there be an offense?
As far as was there, perhaps if there was a recipient, I know you mentioned that it was an intended recipient. If there was someone that received the threat and he had the requisite intent.
All right, let me change it a little. Let's say he says, "I'm going to shoot up the family court on June 1st. He sends that email. The recipient does not see it prior to June 1st coming and going.
So if no one has received the threat, then I would say that the offense has not been consummated under NRS 202.448. The recipient or a receiver is required to complete the crime. And again, that is based upon the language of both the statute itself of 202.448, as well as the definition of oral written electronic communication, the definition of threat that was given, and also the language that Your Honors brought up during my colleague's time, that the verbs used, making a threat, conveying false information, is implies that there's a speaker and there's a recipient. The verbs there are important in determining that there would be a recipient of this threat or false information. In addition, this is all tied to NRS 171.015 as well, when a public offense is consummated within its boundaries. And so obviously we have Mr. Brooks here who's on a video call. He's speaking, he's making the threat, conveying the false information about a mass shooting at the next court hearing. And we have that being received in Clark County, not only to Ms. Coleman, who was the supervision monitor. As I stated, Ms. Brooks, his mother, was there, as well as Ms. Walker. There was also an infant in the room. In addition to...
So in NRS 202.448, sub A, says injure, intimidate, or alarm any person, whether or not any person is actually injured, intimidated, or alarmed. Do you think that helps you or hurts your argument here?
Well, I think it conveys that certainly to commit this crime, there doesn't need to be anyone that is actually injured, because it says whether or not anyone is actually injured. So the effect is not a requirement or an element of the offense. It is the specific intent that the speaker or the defendant must have in making the threat or the false information. And so that required effect on the listener, that is not an element of the crime and does not need to be shown.
When is the crime complete?
The crime is complete when the threat or false information is received. And again, based on the verbs that are used in this statute.
Can you show me where you get that out of the statute's text?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, I don't suggest that the statute says the term listener, but using the verbs that are in, looking at the verbs, making a threat, conveying false information. Again, we have the definition of oral, written, electronic communication in terms of examples of that type of communication. We also have the dictionary definition that was provided in the briefs as far as communication or conveying that includes that information is being transmitted to another, that the communication, the combination of using the terms making a threat, conveying false information, and the mode that that must be done is the oral, written, or electronic communication, convey the idea that there is a speaker of the threat or false information as well as the receiver of that, based on those terms that are specifically used in the statute.
If we were to decide that the statute really doesn't require someone to receive the communication, right? It's just about the making and the intent. Would there be jurisdiction here?
If it does not require a receiver of the threat or the false information, under 171.015, there would not. We also have cited NRS 171.020, which talks about when an act is committed in the state. And one of the elements, again, that I've repeated myself, is oral, written, or electronic communication. And we have that here. That communication is via a video phone call. And so the act of communicating or making the threat, conveying the false information, was done in Clark County, Nevada. And as Your Honors brought up during my colleague's time, right, how do we navigate this brave new world where we're having people over technology? Essentially, in Nevada and in Arizona or in another state at the same time. And I believe that the fact that Mr. Brooks was on the video call in Clark County, which he knew he was in Clark County, he had been at visits prior to with his daughter in Clark County at a Department of Family Services facility with Clark County, personnel that was supervising on behalf of the Department of Family Services, that act was committed in Clark County, Nevada. Clark County, Nevada heard those words when he spoke them. And so based on that, under 171.020, there would be jurisdiction because the act was committed in Nevada, that being over the video phone call, that oral communication happened. And that's not to say that jurisdiction could still be appropriate in multiple locations. I know that there was testimony from Mr. Brooks that he was in Arizona at the time. And if that is to be an accepted fact, certainly he was speaking in Arizona, but also speaking in Nevada. And that's not to limit that saying only Nevada would have jurisdiction, but that both places would have jurisdiction or wherever Mr. Brooks was.
So if he made some sort of broad social media statement that went out to all 50 states that threatened what was going on in, would all 50 states have jurisdiction if they had statutes similar to this one?
Regarding a social media post, again, under 171.015, that if someone received the threat, the crime was consummated. It could speak to multiple jurisdictions having, multiple jurisdictions having jurisdiction. But ultimately, I think that still requires the recipient, as well as having Mr. Brooks having this specific intent to cause someone alarm, to cause panic, to interfere with government operations. And I do believe that perhaps a limiting point of that as well could be the communication, again, anticipating a receiver and tailored to what we know was his own family court case here in Clark County, Nevada. I'd also point out.
So if he were speaking to someone else in Arizona who's involved in this family court case in Nevada and said, the next hearing, I'm going to go there and kill everybody who's present, would that have would that threat have worked? I guess it wouldn't have, or would it, by your reckoning?
That both Mr. Brooks and the person that he's speaking to are both in Arizona, is that correct?
Yes, but it concerns the Nevada case.
Yes, I think at that point that wherever they are, let's say Arizona, if they are both in Arizona, Mr. Brooks is speaking or making that threat, conveying that false information completely within Arizona, then Arizona, it would be completely within Arizona, not.
So even though the threatened conduct was contemplated in Nevada and the person was participating in the proceedings and would be frightened by his threat that he articulated, that would not have a tie to Nevada because the communication was not received in Nevada.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. In addition, I just want to point out the similar nature of State v. DeGraffenreid to this case. And I know that dealt with venue in the sense of we're dealing with different counties in this state. But again, we're dealing with the concept of the crime began in one place, the crime was consummated in a second place. And ultimately, this court found that the crime was consummated upon receipt of that mail. And I understand we're dealing with a different statute that would dealt with forgery and another statute similar to that. But I think the premise is the same here, that venue or jurisdiction can generally lie where a false statement is sent or directed, as well as that a false representation is not complete until the speaker's words have been received. And I think that applies here as well. Again, this court took the time and the opinion to go through the language of that statute specifically, and that it anticipated action upon receipt. It envisioned whether someone would accept those documents or not. And certainly, we're not dealing with forgery here, but the statute and the language of the statute here under 202.448 also anticipates that a listener is receiving that threat or receiving that false information.
Could you address your colleague's arguments on res justi? I'm switching subjects.
Yes, Your Honor.
Completely.
As to the res justi, the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting that evidence. The family court case is so interconnected to this crime that it could not be explained without it. And my colleague on the other side, I think, concedes that the family court case is res justi. I think what the disagreement is to what extent that we can introduce or show that family court case. But the state needed to talk about the fact that the appellant's, Mr. Brooks' child was taken by CPS, and also the threat occurred during a visitation at the Department of Family Services facility and observed by a person that was supervising the visitation. Ms. Coleman, who was the supervising monitor, couldn't explain why she was in the room with any of those people without having the family court case come in.
Sure, Ms. Conlon, but didn't this go a little beyond that in terms of what was admitted? It's not, you know, race justice isn't just like to tell the whole story. You need to tell about the family law case so every single thing in the family law case comes in. Obviously, there has to be some context here, but there was a lot more than that, including specific interactions he had previously had with the court, right? Which seems to me a little more like other act evidence.
And Your Honor, I would say that the district court took great lengths to tailor the evidence that was admitted as far as the family court case and the res justi. There were lengthy arguments as well as the district court not just giving sort of a blanket acceptance to whatever the family court case documents you want to bring in, you can bring in. That was not the nature of the ruling. But what needed to be explained was the underlying events in the family court case that led up to the September 1st, 2023 threat, as well as the hearing that happened subsequent to that, which was September 6th of 2023, which ultimately made the threat of a mass shooting very real in that sense that there did exist a family court hearing that was happening right after that threat was made. And so I don't think it went beyond. It was limited. The district court took great lengths to limit. There was a line-by-line review of the documentation. There were redactions made. There was
Is that race justi or is that other act evidence? Because those two things are different and they're handled very differently.
They are, and I see my time is up if I could answer.
You may answer.
Thank you. As to the res justi, specifically to the family court documents, those were redacted in a line-by-line review. The other bad act certainly was a different analysis, and there was a multi-day Petrocelli hearing, as well as argument, quite frankly, throughout the trial, where the district court was limiting what the state could bring in, and there was limitations as far as the family court case specifically for the res justi that we could not speak about, and the state did not plan to, about the underlying conduct of why the child was taken from Mr. Brooks, as well as the workers or members of Clark County that were involved in his case. They couldn't speak to their specific unit, that they were under 4 years, near fatality, those things.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Just one more question. If there was error there, was it harmless?
As far as admitting specifically just the res justi? Well, I do believe that there was not error in the sense that my colleagues on the other side agree to a certain extent that res justi, the family court case constituted res justi, and that the documents were limited as such that needed to be that needed to come in to explain the threat and the nature of why everyone was in that room that day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd first like to address the idea of communication within 202.448. The statute specifically states that a person shall not, through the use of any means of oral, written, or electronic communication. The way that communication is written in this statute is a noun, not a verb. So the definition of communication within the statute means a message. So the actus reus, which is the actual conduct that is criminalized, is the making of the threat. Is a statement of a threat through a message. So the communication does not require a listener, and the use of the word communication doesn't require a listener. Further, the state's reading of the statute is a very, very narrow reading of the statute in that there has to be a listener, but not only a listener who understands what Brooks is saying. Again, if he's in a crowded room and he is speaking French and he is making these threats with all the intent to alarm people, but no one in the room speaks French, under the state's theory, he has not committed a crime. So Mr. Brooks's theory and what I believe the statute contemplates along, and this is bore out in the legislative history, is that there's broad implications. We want to make sure that we're criminalizing all the threats, not just the ones that are specifically received and understood. Your Honor, my colleague also brought into her argument DeGraffenried. The difference between DeGraffenried in this case is that DeGraffenried had a resulting element. This case does not. The statute specifically legislates no resulting element. If the statute had said that an alarm must occur, injury must occur, or interference with a government operation must occur, then yes, a listener would be required. But they're conflating resulting elements as required by statute and contemplated effects that as was rejected by the United States Supreme Court. Additionally, Your Honors, in this case, Mr. Brooks's conduct solely occurred in Arizona. The intent, the making of the threat happened in Arizona. Arizona could prosecute him. The federal government could prosecute him. But under the reading of 202.448, Nevada can't prosecute him. And it's not as though he's getting away with making a threat. It's just which jurisdiction has the ability to prosecute him and make sure that he's being held accountable.
Can you comment on the res gestae evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. So the res gestae evidence was, it was objected to. It was vigorously objected to. The res gestae evidence that was necessary in this case, because res gestae has to have the same physical and temporal requirement as the crime itself, would have been that Sierra Coleman is a court supervisor and that she was conducting a supervised visitation from a family court order. That is the extent of what the res gestae evidence should have been. The defense did offer a stipulation for that, and as I laid out in my brief, I believe the district court abused its discretion by rejecting that stipulation and allowing the state to present evidence on everything that happened in the family court case, even though it was not res gestae. The stipulation did not impede the prosecution's ability to prove any of the essential elements, and the stipulation narrowed the prejudice so that nothing about another child that Mr. Brooks is not even the biological father to would have come in, nothing about his mental health, nothing about the safety plan that they were putting in place with CPS, nothing about anything that occurred outside of, may I finish?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing that occurred outside of just the relationship between Sierra Coleman and her relationship to Mr. Brooks should have been admitted, and it was error to admit, and it was not harmless. Thank you, Your Honors.
Oh, no, I'm good.
No?
Okay.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted, and we will be, the judges will be in recess, but we would like to have a question and answer session.